From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, life in exile for Africa's first winner of the Nobel Prize for Literature. Writer and dissident Wole Soyinka escaped from Nigeria close to 2 years ago after learning the military dictatorship was going to arrest him. He believes he's still in danger. His latest play is about to be performed in Brooklyn, and he has a new book about the Nigerian crisis. Also, a look at some of the latest research into how the brain works. We'll talk with Pulitzer Prize-winning science writer Ronald Kutulak, author of Inside the Brain. And music critic Ken Tucker reviews the new reunion album of New Edition. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Craig Windham. Defense Secretary William Perry says to the extent that the June terrorist bombing in Saudi Arabia resulted from a failure of military leadership, he is responsible for that failure. The bombing near Dahran killed 19 U.S. airmen. Perry told the House National Security Committee today that he has accepted the criticism in a task force report that said top Pentagon leadership should have made counterterrorism a higher priority and done more to protect soldiers deployed in the Middle East. The first of more than 3,000 troops being sent to strengthen U.S. forces in the Persian Gulf region have left Fort Hood in Texas en route to the Middle East. The Army says the deployment is being staggered over the next 2 to 3 days. The formal mission of the troops is to provide training for Kuwaiti military forces, but they could also be used in any new action against Iraq. GOP presidential nominee Bob Dole plans another attack on Hollywood today. Dole has criticized the entertainment industry for movies that encourage sex and violence. Today he plans to broaden the list to include drug use. NPR's Elizabeth Arnold reports.
Bob Dole speaks at a high school in a Los Angeles suburb today where he'll blast the entertainment industry for glamorizing drug use, with references to movies such as Trainspotting and popular musical groups such as Smashing Pumpkins. Dole will make the case that heroin use is being depicted as hip as opposed to dangerous. The last time Dole campaigned here, he attacked the movie industry for an irresponsible attitude toward sex and crime. It's unclear whether Dole's efforts towards influencing popular culture are paying off. President Clinton has taken steps himself, most notably the V-chip that ostensibly allows parents to screen out television shows they don't wish their children to see. Despite Clinton's lead here in California, Dole shows no sign of giving up on the state, where a number of congressional Republicans are fighting to hold on to their seats. I'm Elizabeth Arnold in Burbank.
Former Vice President Spiro Agnew died yesterday at a hospital in Maryland. The cause of death has not been released. He was 77 years old. Agnew was an obscure governor when Richard Nixon chose him as his running mate in 1968. Agnew resigned in disgrace in 1973 after pleading no contest to a single count of income tax evasion, and he withdrew from public life.
I believe that America has always thrived on adversity. And so I can foresee only good ahead for this country, despite my personal sorrow at leaving public service and leaving many objectives incomplete. Under this administration, which you have chosen and in which I have been privileged to serve, the longest war in America's history has been brought to an honorable end.
Agnew's most famous line came in a 1970 speech when he attacked the news media as nattering nabobs of nepotism. The Dow Jones Industrial Average is currently down nearly 9 points in moderate trading. This is NPR. The nation's trade deficit grew by 43% in July to $11.7 billion. Imports of Chinese-made toys and foreign oil helped put the gap at its highest level in more than 8 years. That leaves the trade deficit running at an annual pace of $1.9 billion. The deficit with Japan went to its highest level since last October. Muslim leader Alija Izetbegović has won the most votes in Bosnia's presidential election, sparking street celebrations in Sarajevo today. He will become the first chairman of the new three-man presidency in Bosnia. The bodies of 11 suspected North Korean infiltrators have been found on a hillside in South Korea following a massive search by South Korean troops and police. One of the North Koreans has been captured alive, and another 8 or 9 may still be at large. Charles Scanlon reports from Seoul.
Bodies of the 11 North Koreans were found by a police helicopter on a hillside about 3 miles from the coast. A spokesman for South Korea's defense ministry said they appeared to have committed suicide. But there are unconfirmed reports that one of the North Koreans may have shot the others before killing himself. Shortly before the bodies were discovered, another suspected infiltrator was captured alive. He's reported to have told police that a total of 20 North Koreans had come ashore. He said he belonged to a reconnaissance wing of the North Korean Defense Ministry, but the mission had gone wrong when their submarine developed engine trouble. The submarine was found abandoned where it ran aground on South Korea's rocky east coast. A large search operation is continuing for other North Korean agents and crew who are thought to be still on the run. For National Public Radio, this is Charles Scanlon in Seoul.
The O.J. Simpson wrongful death civil suit is getting underway in Santa Monica, California. Before jury selection begins, the judge has some remaining pre-trial issues to consider, including a possible relaxing of his strict gag order. A judge in New York has formally ended efforts to make a Brooklyn man return to jail in Florida. He escaped from a chain gang 44 years ago and has stayed out of trouble ever since. I'm Craig Windham, NPR News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Nigerian writer Wole Soyinka, the first African to win the Nobel Prize for Literature, was forced into exile 1 year and 8 months ago. Not long after he fled, dissident writer Ken Sarawiwa was executed along with 8 other activists. The dictator of Nigeria, General Sani Abacha, seized power in 1993, shortly after a democratic election was annulled by Abacha's predecessor. The winner of that election, Moshood Abiola, is now a political prisoner. Wole Soyinka is calling for international sanctions against the dictatorship. He says he's been traveling a lot since going into exile, but he spent much of the past few months in the United States. In October, the Brooklyn Academy of Music will present his latest play, The Beatification of Area Boy. Soyinka also has a new book called The Open Sore of a Continent. I asked him how he knew it was time to flee Nigeria.
One of the ways one survives under a brutal dictatorship, such as Abacha's, is by ensuring that one keeps some kind of information line, even within the, you know, the heart or the core of the regime itself. I was going to say the heart, but I don't think this regime has any heart. And this includes the secret services, the military, civil servants, and we get a lot of information that way. Even up till this moment, I can almost tell you what Abacha is planning for his October 1st speech. That's the Independence Day celebrations in Nigeria.
What is he planning?
Well, he's planning to make some token releases of some prisoners in order to appease the international community, perhaps. In particular, the Commonwealth countries who've given him all sorts of wishy-washy deadlines. And so he'll release a few prisoners. He's not going to release the main person, the president-elect of Nigeria. No, he's going to hold out for some stiffer bargaining, some concessions from the Commonwealth and from the international community. And then he's going to announce that he's... He's embarked on a cleansing project, you know, corruption and so on and so forth. We know pretty well the substance of what Abacha is going to announce in October.
So you're saying that there are dissidents in the military who leak information?
Yes, who pass on information within the military, within the secret services, yes. And many of us, I must say, depend very much on them for our survival. Even outside here, I can tell you that.
Are you in danger outside of Nigeria?
I'm afraid so, yes. Not just myself. A number of other activists, democracy activists, in danger outside.
Are you living in semi-hiding, not telling people where you sleep and so on?
That is true, yes. This is I keep my residential address secret.
Does having a Nobel Prize protect you in any way?
No, I'm afraid not. Now, in general, it is true that winning the Nobel Prize protects writers, some writers, scientists, and so on in certain countries. But we have a very strange phenomenon in Nigeria, and unfortunately, the large part of the world is not yet aware of this fact. This is somebody who really thrives at delivering shocks to the civilized world.
Who, the General Abacha, the dictator?
General Abacha, yes, yes, that's his mentality. He's a psychopath. He loves humiliating even his fellow African heads of states. Look at the way he's been treating Nelson Mandela, for instance, somebody whom we all revere. He's the icon of African self-worth, self-being, recognition, sense of independence, and sense of racial worth. And the insults which Abacha has been casting at Abacha is something which just appalls.
What has he said about Nelson Mandela?
Nelson Mandela, both he directly and his Minister of Information at one time, his Foreign Affairs Minister, Ikime, when Nelson Mandela was taking a principled stand against him, he made his foreign minister say that Nelson's long imprisonment had addled his brain, something like that. Now, for any African leader to say that about Nelson Mandela, it shows there's nothing else to be said. So for somebody like Abacha, nothing would give him the greater pleasure than to have the privilege of hanging, of saying to the world, yes, I've hanged a Nobel Prize winner, I've had him shot or executed, the same way as he executed the environmental activist and writer Ken Saro-Wiwa, hanged him despite all the protestations of the world after a secret trial, which everybody admits, at least outside Abacha's caucus and apologists, was one of the greatest travesties of justice ever committed, in the contemporary world.
The New York Times had an editorial this week urging the United States to impose sanctions on Nigeria, to take a harder stand against the dictatorship. I was wondering if you were recently at an editorial meeting with the New York Times.
No, I haven't spoken to the New York Times in ages. But I applaud that stand. And let me urge that there is really no option if, in the end, the civilized world everywhere, across the entire globe, is not going to feel ashamed of its inertia and its attitude of compromise over this issue. Canada, let me single out Canada in particular as one of the principled countries over this issue. Canada has never wavered in recognition of the fact that a monster has been loosened upon the world. Canada has got sick of the pussyfooting of the Commonwealth countries and has decided to take unilateral action against Nigeria. The result is that Nigeria has been forced to close down its mission in Canada as a kind of protest, the usual empty-headed gesture of bravado. But Canada and one or two other Commonwealth countries, Australia, New Zealand, not quite as strong as Canada. I mean, these are principled directions.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Nobel Prize-winning writer Wole Soyinka. And he's been living in exile from Nigeria for close to 2 years. He has a new book called The Open Sore of a Continent, a personal narrative of the Nigerian crisis. And his play, The Beatification of Area Boy, will be performed next month at the Brooklyn Academy of Music. Ken Saro-Wiwa was hanged last year for being a dissident and for protesting oil interests in the country and their pollution of land and water there. He was a playwright. Were you a friend of his?
Yes, he was. We're not all that close. We sort of created in different orbits and so on. But he was the president of my National Union of Writers for 2 years. We became, I got to know him very well, especially since he became involved in the Ogoni struggle. And to have accused Ken Saro-Wiwa of being of complicity in the murders of some local chiefs of his own people is one of the most grotesque charges that could ever be filed against somebody like Ken Saro-Wiwa. It's just preposterous.
Did his hanging really hit you hard because here was a fellow writer being hung?
Hard. I was traumatized for quite a number of days. What made it particularly bad for me was that I had been in Auckland Remember that his hanging took place virtually on the eve of the Commonwealth Heads of State's conference. And I traveled there on my way to Japan to emphasize, to try and get these heads of states to understand that we know Abacha, they do not. That was the message. I said, he will hang this man and his colleagues, nine of them altogether. He will hang them unless you send a message and back it up with some kind of action which makes Abacha understand that he means business. I spoke to heads of states, foreign ministers, and I left. By the time I left, something happened. Some communication came from home, which made me convinced that Ken and his companions were doomed. So I left, in fact, before the conference actually started. I'd done all I could, and I was in Tokyo when the news came. And as I said, I was just traumatized for at least 3 days.
Well, Eshayenka is my guest, Nobel Prize-winning writer. He's been living in exile from Nigeria for close to 2 years. Let's take a short break, and then we'll talk some more. This is Fresh Air. Back with Wole Eshayenka, Nobel Prize-winning writer from Nigeria who's been living in exile from his country for close to 2 years. He has a new book called The Open Sore of a Continent, a personal narrative of the Nigerian crisis. And his play, The Beatification of Area Boy, will be performed in early October at the Brooklyn Academy of Music. In your new extended essay, The Open Sore of a Continent, a personal narrative of the Nigerian crisis, you write that you were in the middle of a riot in June of 1993. This is a riot against a previous dictator, Babangida.
Babangida, yes.
And you write, during the most violent day of the anti-Babangida riots, I was trapped within the tumult of thousands that submerged my car, sat, drummed, or danced on it. Voices would ring out with shouts, lead us out of this mess called Nigeria. We can make it on our own. Would you tell us what it was like to be in the middle of a riot against this dictator, and how did you end up in the middle of it?
What happened was I was flying back home, and the tension at home was such that Air France refused to fly into Lagos. Now, I was determined to get back in time, you know, because the struggle had begun to oust Babangida. I left the country just about a few weeks before. I hadn't planned for less than a few weeks before. I hadn't planned to be out, you know, that long. And then Air France said, no, they were going to overfly Nigeria and fly to Cotonou, that's the Republic of Benin. I said, okay, I'll fly to Benin, and then I'll go by public transport, you know, by a road to Nigeria. And so that's what I did. And that's how I ended up right in the middle of the most violent day of the entire anti-Babangida riot. And they recognized me at once, and then...
When you say they, do you mean the rioters or the police?
Well, I should really call them demonstrators, because they were not rioters.
Right, it was the demonstrators.
The demonstrators, yes.
And what sparked this uprising?
Oh, it was the annulment of the elections. The elections of June 12, 1993, which were considered by the international community, by observers everywhere, by even the agencies of Babangida's government, as the freest and fairest ever conducted in Nigeria.
How did this demonstration become a riot?
It became a riot when the police and the MOPO, that's the mobile police, usually called Kilango, and the military, under the direct orders of Abacha, this very dictator who's there, he was number two, when they began to open fire on the demonstrators. And there was panic and, of course, reprisals here and there. And Abacha personally led. And this I confirm, and I've said it over and over again. Other journalists who were present have said it. This regime cannot deny it. Abacha, who's number two, personally led in his Amotkar, you know, his bulletproof car, led detachments of soldiers and ordered them to open fire on the demonstration, on the demonstrators.
What did you do when you realized that the police were opening fire on the demonstrators?
Well, it's a pretty weird situation. The first thing, of course, was you couldn't talk because everybody, you know, ran for cover. But what I did do, and of course they would regroup, reassemble, and so on and so forth, and take on the soldiers and the police here and there. But at night, I received, as darkness fell, I received information that Abacha's people, because the demonstrators were determined to stay the whole night. They were going to stay by their fires, their roadblocks, and so on. And I received information that they were going to, there was going to be a blitz during the night. So I was responsible in the Ipaja sector, that's in Lagos, towards Abeokuta, Ota, Agege. I then went around and told them to disperse. I said, people were going to come at night and shoot them using the cover of darkness, arrest some, you know, roll over others. And I pleaded with them to go home. And fortunately, they did. I said, listen, go home and come back if you wish in the daytime. But listen to the radio. Listen to what your leaders are telling you. But don't stay out during the night, because we learned what they planned to do to the demonstrators during the night.
Did they disperse after that?
They dispersed. They dispersed and regrouped the following morning. They dispersed.
In your new extended essay, The Open Sore of a Continent, you question the whole concept of nationhood. Why are you questioning that now?
From the moment that nations on the African continent began really to call themselves independent nations and conscious of the history of those nations, that they were in fact artificial creations of European imperialist interests, countries. Sometimes even these countries were created by trading companies, and then the boundaries were approved, supported by military means or by negotiations with other predatory European nations who recognized as countries. And so when the Organization of African Unity came into existence, I was frankly, and stated it at the time, I was shocked by the fact that one of the, shall we say, founding principles of this organization was a respect, the sacrosanctity of colonially given boundaries. I found that personally humiliating and racially humiliating. Here you are before the Europeans came. You were different nations. You had different peoples. You had treaties between different nations. You had certain economic arrangements which operated within certain boundaries. Along come some interlopers who managed to conquer here, negotiate there, give you new entities which are not organic. We do not correspond to your history, do not correspond to your economic interactions, your cultural realities, your languages, even traditional religions. And then when you recover your racial integrity from these people, the first thing you do is to say that we hold these boundaries inviolable. So there's always been that sense of, you know, resentment. It's crept up in a number of essays and so on within Nigeria and on the African continent. But it was really when the military, the tyrants, took over and began spouting this language that it really became a daily a kind of negative bombardment. One was compelled to say, wait a minute, what is really at stake here? In whose interest are these boundaries? And then you look at the entire continent, you look at Sudan with this nearly 30-year-old war between the north and the south, and you ask, who has locked us in this mindless embrace? Why is it that we cannot sit down and really negotiate, go back and negotiate the truthful, you know, boundaries of our nationhoods?
Nigeria was one of the first African countries to get its independence from the colonial power that had ruled it. This was in 1960. It got its independence from England. Mm-hmm. Did you think that the future of the country would have a more kind of idealistic political shape to it? Did you?
Oh, absolutely. 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 We were, we didn't think that all the task was done. What we saw, in fact, was the task to be done in the future. And we felt that we were up to it. We saw a vision of Nigeria, which extended even beyond Nigerian borders, you know, all the way to South Africa, to Kenya, where the Mau Mau liberation movement was just, was still raging in terms of activities. We were conscious of the brutal Portuguese colonialism in Mozambique, Angola, Guinea-Bissau. We're conscious of the dehumanization of Africans by the Belgians in the former Republic of Congo. And we saw our attainment of independence as a challenge. It was not just Nigeria we were going to rebuild. It was the entire African continent. And we're absolutely confident that we could do it.
Do you expect to be in exile for a long time?
When I left, I was pretty confident that there were enough forces of opposition within the military, the police, the trade unions, and the student bodies and the civic society, the professional organizations. I was confident that within a year we should see the exit of this dictator. But there have been so many sellouts in the ranks, many, many sellouts on many fronts. And so right now I am a little bit more careful about predicting to myself how long he'll be able to stay there. All I know is that every day efforts are being redoubled in all the various sectors I've mentioned, and that he'll go the way of all dictators sooner than later.
Thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you.
Well, Shoyanka's new book is called The Open Sore of a Continent. Shoyanka's latest play, The Beatification of Area Boy, will be performed October 9th through 13th at the Brooklyn Academy of Music's Majestic Theater. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Borders, where the love of books and music sets the standard. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, Inside the Brain, we talk with Pulitzer Prize-winning science writer Ronald Kutulak about some of the latest scientific discoveries about the brain. And music critic Ken Tucker reviews New Edition's reunion album. Thank you. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. New research into the development and functioning of the brain has implications for our understanding of education, child-rearing, criminal behavior, treatment of mental illness, and memory enhancement. This research is the subject of the new book, Inside the Brain, by Chicago Tribune science writer Ronald Kutulak. He won a 1994 Pulitzer Prize for two series of articles he wrote about brain research. He's covered brain research for 20 years. Children are able to learn so much so fast, an ability we seem to lose as adults. Kutulak says one explanation for this is that an infant's brain has extra wiring.
Well, there's a tremendous growth of synaptic connections. These are the sort of telephone lines connecting brain cells, allows them to communicate. From birth to about the age of 5 or 6, they actually grow so rapidly that at some points they're being developed at the rate of about 3 billion a second. And you eventually end up with about 1,000 trillion of these, which means that you've got a lot of computing power. The brain overproduces synapses during this period, which is a critical period of learning, so that it has the ability to adjust to any kind of environment that it finds itself in, whether it's in Calcutta or Chicago, so that it can adjust to the food, the language, the culture, all the things it needs to.
So the more that a baby or a youngster is exposed to, the more connections will be made in their brain and the more of those synapses will be used?
Well, actually, the more synapses will be retained, because you end up with 1,000 trillion, but then they begin to decline, mm-hmm. Which is a normal part of the developmental process. But the more stimulation you have, the more experience you have in this critical period, the more synapses you'll retain.
And a synapse is what?
Well, this is what gives you your brain power. It allows you to make associations. It allows you to make connections. They've shown in animal studies that rats, for example, that are raised in a stimulating environment will have, say, something like 25% more synaptic connections than rats raised in just a humdrum kind of environment with little stimulation.
So is it a move it or lose it kind of thing? If you don't make these connections by a certain age, the synapses disappear or never get formed?
Exactly. It's a use it or lose it situation. I think that's such a critical thing to come out of all this new research, that the people who do use their brains more actually live longer and are healthier and have a less of a risk of developing Alzheimer's disease.
Now, you say scientists have learned that the equivalent of maps are made in the brain early on, maps that govern vision and language, muscle movement, hearing, and many other things. What are these maps?
Well, they're areas of the brain that process things like vision or language, speech, thoughts, reasoning. And they need to be stimulated in order for them to develop properly. For example, if you never learn to speak or are exposed to language up to the age of, say, 11 years old, you will be unable to speak, no matter how much training you get afterward, because the part of your brain that's normally would process language has not learned how to do so and is no longer able to do so. And the same thing happens with vision. They show this in a very critical experiment with eyesight in cats, where they closed one eye and for 2 weeks during a critical period in early development. And then when they opened it, the eye was anatomically sound, I mean, perfect, but the cats couldn't see out of the eye. And they found that the wiring of the brain cells that normally would process that vision from that eye had diverted to go to do other jobs, either to improve the vision of the uncovered eye or to do some other tasks in the brain.
So there are certain systems of learning almost that you have to learn when you're young.
Exactly. And I think that that's being borne out now. The realization of this biological understanding of how the brain gets built has a major impact on society in terms of how we look at youngsters. The Head Start, for example, has usually that starts around 4 or 5 years of age, but they've now started a new program called Early Start, which is going to start shortly after birth and up to the age of the Head Start, because there's a growing realization in all areas, the federal government and local groups that are interested in this area, that it's such a critical period from 0 to 3.
Well, I guess one of the things you're telling us is that the good news is that if you're in a situation where you're learning a lot as a child, then you'll have a brain that is growing and strong and so on. But the bad news is if you're in an environment where there isn't a lot of stimulation, you're going to have the potential of being troubled for the rest of your life.
Yes, that's a rather dreary prospect, a frightening prospect to realize that that's going on today, actually. Studies indicate that a baby born to a woman who has, say, an unmarried teenager who has less than 12 years of education has 4 times the risk of developing mental retardation than a child born to a woman with more than 12 years of education. And this goes across all socioeconomic, ethnic lines. It doesn't matter. It's just a fact of biology.
What is the relationship between a woman's education and mental retardation in her child?
I think it's as simple as stimulation, as providing the proper kind of experiences that the baby's brain needs to develop. They've shown that you can do this. When you get, for example, you take 2 groups of children born into impoverished neighborhoods, and one group you subject to educational experiences, stimulating kinds of play, organized things, and get the parents involved as well and learning these new things and how to stimulate their infants. And then you compare that years later to a similar group that just lived their normal lives the way they did. And there's a tremendous increase in the IQ level, that they're basically up to 100 IQ points, which is normal, as compared to, say, about 75 IQ for the ones who did not get this kind of stimulation.
Now, you were telling us before that when a child is young, maps are made in the brain, maps that control the development of language and vision and conceptualization, muscle movement, hearing, and so on. You say at the same time, early exposure to violence and to stress can affect how these maps are made.
Yes, that's one of the new things that scientists are finding, that exposure to bad environments where there's stress, violence, lack of good stimulation, lack of any kind of input from a parent that would be helpful, which we consider to be normal, that in this case, the brain actually goes into a mode where it adapts to that kind of a bad environment. And it does so by changing the levels of various brain chemicals called neurotransmitters, such as serotonin and noradrenaline. And as a result, the adaptation is one that leads a person to become more aggressive or violent, because that's what the brain sees it needs to survive in this kind of environment.
Are you saying that a youngster can actually become wired for aggressive responses?
Yes, yes. Not all, by any means. I think most people growing up, even in the worst circumstances, turn out to be fine. But there are some people who are more genetically vulnerable. And you have to understand that people have all these variations, and they depend upon the genes that they're born with in terms of what they're susceptible to. Some people are more susceptible to say, for cancer or heart disease, for example. Others are more susceptible to bad environments causing the alteration in brain chemicals that makes them more prone to become aggressive and violent.
If you're just joining us, my guest is science writer Ronald Kutulak. He's the author of the new book, Inside the Brain, about the last few years of brain research. Let's take a short break and then we'll talk some more. This is Fresh Air. Back with Ronald Kutulak, author of the book Inside the Brain. He's a science writer, and his new book is about brain research. Well, let's look at one of the brain chemicals that you write about, a serotonin. What does serotonin do in so-called normal levels?
Serotonin is such a fascinating chemical. It's just wonderful to study this because it seems to be the one of the major chemicals in the brain that sort of modulates impulses, whether it's aggression, sex, eating, all the kinds of things that we're prone to keep them in balance so that you can live in a society and get along with other people and do well. And when you have a low serotonin level, the control over these impulses is less. And they've shown that. And actually, this is relatively new. The first time it was ever shown was in 1976, I think it was in Sweden, when they first showed that people who attempted violent suicide had low serotonin levels. And then they found it in New York among people who like to set fires, that, again, that they had low serotonin levels. And thirdly, they found it among people who were aggressive, that they also tend to have low serotonin levels.
So this research is really redefining what people believe about nature and nurture?
Oh, absolutely. It used to be this old idea that it's either nature or nurture. Well, I think the new research is showing that it's both, and probably in pretty equal measures, that the genes and how they get affected by the environment, and then the environment, how that's interpreted by the genes, or how they play themselves out in the brain.
Now, on a related level, there's been some interesting research that you write about in your book, Inside the Brain, about the effect on infants or on newborn animals when the mother licks the animal or strokes the baby, that sense of physical attention.
Well, again, that's part of the brain responding to its environment. The first studies on that was done with the rats, and it showed that the newborn pups, when they were isolated from their mothers, failed to thrive. They just went into sort of a limbo kind of existence where they just didn't do much of anything, and if that kept on for a while, they died. But the scientists found that the mother's licking was a signal that sent to the brain that told it that everything was okay, food was available, warmth was there, and all the other things that are necessary. But the scientists also could stimulate that same response with a wet artist brush by stroking the animals to make them think that the mother was licking them. And that translated very importantly to newborns who are premature. It wasn't too long ago that they used to have signs on the nurseries, in the newborn nurseries, that said, do not touch, because they thought, well, if you just kept these babies quiet, that they would do better, because they were always sort of a little hyper, any little thing where they'd start crying. And after this research came out showing that this licking or the artist brush stroking could calm down the stress hormones in the brains of these animals, they tried it out in humans and these premature babies. And sure enough, newborns aren't licked, but they're held and the backs are rubbed. And they had this amazing result that these babies, when they were given this kind of appropriate touch, thrived much better, they ate better, and they were more normal as a result. I mean, that's a fantastic. And now all over the world, the new prematures are now given this treatment of being held and robbed and thriving much better.
If you're just joining us, my guest is science writer Ronald Kutulak, and he's the author of the new book, Inside the Brain, about the latest brain research. Now, what are the implications of this recent research for adult learning? Do we know more about what you need to do to really absorb and keep information as an adult?
Yeah, I think it's so encouraging for adult learning. For one thing, we don't lose, you know, they used to say a million brain cells a day. Well, that's turned out to be a myth. Secondly, the brain is always capable of learning. It's what they call plastic, which means that it changes. These synaptic connections change. They either get stronger or weaker, or you build new ones when new learning occurs. And that occurs throughout life. And when they do studies on, for example, education, the more education you have, and it's a linear relationship, the more education you have, the longer you live, the healthier you are, and the less risk of developing Alzheimer's or other neurodegenerative disorders.
Well, what's the connection between education and living longer?
Two things. Number one is biological. That is, if you've built more synaptic connections, more networks in your brain, you have more brain power, you're able to withstand destructive forces of Alzheimer's much more, so that you may never develop symptoms, even though you may have the disease. Whereas somebody with many fewer synaptic connections with the same type of disease will have symptoms rather early because they don't have that buffer, that extra supply of synaptic connections that can help you withstand the deleterious effects of Alzheimer's. And secondly, it allows you to, it's sort of like a vaccine. It allows you to develop immunity toward a lot of the bad risks that are out there that people often take. People who have more education are less likely to smoke, for example, are less likely to be obese, less likely to be inactive, physically inactive, which are major causes of physical deterioration and death.
Some interesting research being done on estrogen replacement therapy and memory in women after menopause. What's the connection that scientists think exists now between estrogen and memory?
Well, it turns out that estrogen, which was once thought to be primarily a female sex hormone, actually has many roles in the body. And one of the key places that it does good work is in the brain. It's sort of like what they call a neurotrophic factor. It keeps brain cells active and healthy and alive and functioning on all cylinders. And when that declines, the brain cells then sort of become inactive. They sputter. They don't do the job as well. They're more susceptible to Alzheimer's disease. And men have estrogen in their brain as well. It does the same kind of work. And they get their estrogen from testosterone, which is sort of chemically altered slightly to produce estrogen. So both men and women need estrogen in their brains to keep the brain cells healthy. And they've been finding on these population studies that women who take estrogen replacement after menopause are far less likely to develop Alzheimer's than women who don't.
I'm wondering if you've thought about the social implications of the latest brain research, the research on the chemistry of the brain and early mapping within the brain. What should we be thinking about as a larger society?
Well, I think that it has a tremendous implication in this area. And I think that maybe the story can best be told by a parallel example. In the 1950s, it was still thought that people who had mental disorders were at fault. They did it to themselves somehow. And we were in the process of building more and more mental institutions to house people with mental problems, because there's nothing basically that we could do for them. Then along came, in the late 1950s, along came the first antipsychotic drugs. And that did two things. Number one, it showed that the mental illness is biological, because you had a chemical that restored you know, sanity in a sense to these people, reverse their mental problems. And number two, it ended that binge of building new mental hospitals. I think what we're seeing today is a similar thing occurring with the brain and aggression and violence. That is, we're beginning to understand that it starts off early because of the fact that you're exposed to bad kinds of environments that trigger these kind of unacceptable responses in the brain. And as a result, we tend to see it as a problem at the end where we build more prisons. And a lot of politicians call for building more prisons and at the same time taking away education and food from youngsters. It's totally a wrong approach. I mean, what we have to do is go at the starting point to prevent these kind of problems from happening rather than just sort of zeroing in on building more prisons. And I think that's eventually going to happen as it did with mental diseases.
Well, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Well, thank you.
Ronald Kutulak is the Chicago Tribune's science writer. His new book is called Inside the Brain. Coming up, New Edition's reunion album, This is Fresh Air. New Edition came out of Boston and hit the big time in the 80s with snappy tunes like Candy Girl and Popcorn Love. Since then, the group's members have released a series of solo albums with mixed artistic and commercial success. In recent years, group member Bobby Brown has been more famous as Whitney Houston's husband than as a hitmaker. Now they've gotten back together to release the first New Edition album in a decade, Home Again.
I've been away for much too long. I hope you still feel I belong. I didn't mean to cause you pain. Nothing to lose, much more to gain. Just when I thought that we were through, I found my
Home Again arrives with a certain amount of skepticism in its wake. Start with the assumption that this reunion is born of a certain desperation. That's because the last solo releases by Bobby Brown, Johnny Gill, Ralph Tresvant, and the remaining three, who performed under the name Belle Biv DeVoe, were commercial disappointments wherever they weren't outright bombs. Then take a look at the album credits and note Home Again's laundry list of producers, including Sean Puffy Combs, Gerald Levert, the team of Jimmy Jam and Terry Lewis, and others. No way this isn't going to be a discombobulated jumble, right? Well, not exactly.
At home, all alone, thinking to myself, what a fool. I take back every word.
While certainly uneven, much of the music on Home Again is satisfying because it achieves a neat paradox, urgent ease. You can hear it most strikingly on Hear Me Out, the beautifully layered multi-harmony ballad I just played. And then there's the collection's knockout track, Something About You, a fresh Jam Lewis composition that updates New Jack Swing for the 90s. It features Brown and Trayvant crooning about how, quote, this addictive love's about to do me in. Something about you, babe. Something about you, babe. Change the way I looked at me. It's an obsession, babe. Or just curiosity. Taking advantage, babe. Of my sensitivity. Do what you wanna, babe. Just give back my sanity. Oh, no other love's affected me before. Girl, you changed the rules, but I come back for more. I'm a player in this game, I'll never win. This addictive love's about to do me in. Home Again has its slow patches, most notably in a gangsta-rappy first single, Hit Me Off, and Johnny Gill's overblown gospel number, Thank You, the JG Interlude. There are a lot of old-fashioned R&B touches on Home Again. Marvin Gaye-ish moans, Michael Jacksonite squeals, Teddy Pendergrassy growls. These are amusing, but they also remind you that what New Edition has always lacked is much of a distinctive group identity. While their themes and melodies have matured, their solid music still doesn't reveal much about the men making it.
Ken Tucker is critic at large for Entertainment Weekly. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our program was produced today by Joan Tui Westman. Our interviews and reviews are produced by Amy Sallet, Naomi Person, Phyllis Myers, and Roberta Sharrock. Alan Tu directed the show. I'm Tariq Gross.
No addition. You don't have to
Fresh Air is available on cassette. To order, call 1-800-934-6000. That's 1-800-934-6000. The cost is $15.45 and includes shipping and handling. Not all programs are available.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and from Crown Publishing Group, publisher of Downsize This, Random Threats from an Unarmed American by Michael Moore, creator of TV Nation and Roger and Me. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, film critic David Denby on the debate over political correctness and the great books of the Western tradition. Also, screenwriter and director Allison Anders talks about her new film, Grace of My Heart. I'm Tariq Gross. Join us for the next Fresh Air.